Now we're going to take a look at another very important aspect of the corporate underpinnings of Mussolini's Italy. We're going to take a look at one of the most important chapters in the history of Italian fascism, one of the best-known chapters, namely the kidnapping and assassination of Italian socialist parliamentary deputy Giacomo Matteotti. His last name is M-A-T-T-E-O-T-T-I. And Matteotti basically helped expose fascism as a spoil system for big business. For his trouble, he was kidnapped and assassinated. And again, in any competent history of Mussolini's Italy, the assassination of Matteotti, the death of Matteotti, is one of the main chapters. Now we're going to take a look at what it was that Matteotti had to reveal, and we're going to take a look at some of Matteotti's specific data. Now, in observing how Matteotti helped expose the fraudulent aspects of Mussolini's corporate state, whereas the corporate state was being represented as something which was going to benefit society as a whole. In fact, it merely benefited almost exclusively benefited the main corporate backers of Mussolini's March on Rome in 1922. Giacomo Matteotti exposed that and was killed for his trouble. Resuming again with George Seldes' narrative in Facts and Fascism, repeating part of the narrative from the previous passage, the reason Matteotti had to die was because he committed the one unforgivable crime in the fascist Matteotti had to die because he committed the one unforgivable crime in a fascist nation. He exposed the prophets in fascism. There is no program, no policy, no ideology, and certainly no philosophy back of fascism as there is back of almost every other form of government. It is nothing but a spoil system. Skipping down. It was Matteotti who discovered in 1924 that Mussolini, who had marched to Rome in a Pullman sleeper in 1922, was beginning to pay back the secret forces which had paid the money to put fascism in power in the first place. On May 27th, a few days before he was kidnapped and assassinated by Mussolini's gangsters and family friends, Matteotti denounced in the Italian Parliament a law which would have given a monopoly in oil to the Sinclair firm, the same corporation run by Harry Sinclair, which was involved in the filthy muck of the Teapot Dome scandal, and, incidentally, the same Harry Sinclair who told Dorothy Thompson that he and his associates put up most of the money to buy the presidency of the United States every 4 years. On June 10th, 1924, when the entire front pages of the American press were given over to the Loeb-Leopold case in Chicago, Matteotti was killed by Mussolini's own orders and not a line appeared in most newspapers. On the 16th, Arnaldo, brother of the Duce, printed a warning in his Popolo d'Italia against public clamor for an investigation of the murder, saying such a request was in reality a demand that Mussolini abdicate. But the London Daily Herald told the truth. Matteotti, having challenged the Sinclair oil deal, had prepared a documentary exposé proving that Balbo, Grandi, Arnaldo Mussolini himself, and the biggest men in the fascist government had been engaged in a tremendous graft and corruption deal in relation to the oil monopoly. For all this, the Undersecretary of Home Affairs, Finzi, F-I-N-Z-I, was made the scapegoat. The evidence was plain that he was among the grafters, and as he was also one of the big financial profiteers of a fascist law legalizing gambling, he resigned in an uproar. In apology, the Roman press said that, quote, thousands of jailbirds have joined the fascist party since the March on Rome, unquote, and that Finzi was not a good party member. Finzi was a small shot. Matteotti was using the Sinclair oil graft scandal to hit at the big shots, and the fascists were throwing Finzi to the mob to save the real profiteers of the system. Matteotti had prepared a documentation which showed that the big bankers, the great industrial baronies such as Ansaldo, the great landowners, and the war profiteers who had made billions while Italy hungered were to be given the wealth of Italy. Here is a small part of Matteotti's documentation. And note here, as we go through Matteotti's documentation of Mussolini's corporate state as a spoil system, as Seldes calls it, for the top industrialists and financiers, it's worth taking note of how many of the better-known names from Italian business here crop up in connection with Mussolini. Many names that are familiar to contemporary Americans figure prominently in the history of Italian fascism. Ansaldo, here is a small part of Matteotti's documentation. Ansaldo, a decree law of June 14, 1923, supplied national funds for refloating this private corporation, whose owners had been chiefly responsible for the bankruptcy of the Banca di Scanto. The fascist regime, with 72 million lira against 78 million lira worth of shares given the creditors, became almost half owner. It also took a mortgage for 41,500,000 lira. Fascism subsidized the Ansaldo Shipbuilding Company at 900 lira a ton. It gave Ansaldo 230 locomotives for repair without accepting competitive bids. Fiume Mineral Oil Refining Company. On April 29, 1923, the fascist state purchased 18,000 shares of this corporation for 8,300,443 lira. It made itself party to the success of this private firm. Among the new directors the state put on the governing board were three of the fascists of the first hour, unquote, Dino Grandi, Massimo Rocca, and Eugenio Magrini. Banking houses. The Banco di Roma was in the same straits as the Scanto. When the latter failed, it appealed to Mussolini as a friend and subsidizer of the fascist movement, and Musso the Duce repaid the directors by bypassing the old law requiring them to make good the bank's losses. One of the men who profited most was a certain Senator Marconi, member of the board of the Scanto, who suddenly joined the fascist party in October of 1923. In November, Mattiotti showed, he was relieved of the financial burden of putting up his fortune to repay the poor devils who had trusted the Scanto and lost all their money. This is, of course, the same Marconi who claimed he had invented the radio, a claim disputed by several. That Marconi made a fortune in wireless is beyond dispute. Interrupting briefly, of course, the Marconi name in Italian electronics, one of the best-known names, and it's worth noting here that he's also one of the primary backers of and beneficiaries of fascism, and that in turn he was enabled by the fascist state to escape the consequences of some bank failures which he had been party to. Similar in certain respects, again, not an exact analogy, but similar in certain respects to what we see going on with the SNLs today here in February of 1990. Continuing with George Seldes' account. War profiteers. Every nation had a war profiteering scandal after 1918. Mussolini, in his demagogic orations in which he promised everything to everybody, said that he would take back every cent the profiteers made. At the very time he was saying this, Mussolini, as Mattiotti later revealed, was accepting big money from the very same profiteers for organizing his black shirts and outfitting them with clubs and revolvers. The various regimes before October 1922 had begun the investigation of the war profiteering frauds, and several suits resulted in large sums being regained. Mussolini had denounced these suits as slow, the sums returned as small. He promised quick suits and complete confiscation of all the property of the war profiteers. On November 19, 1922, less than a month after he took office, Mussolini, with a sweep of his pen, wrote Decree No. 1487, which abolished the Committee of Inquiry into War Profiteering, and the crooks who paid for his election were relieved of all worry. The Società Italiana per le FS del Mediterraneo, a private whale railway line, was granted treasury bonds up to 100 million lira by Decree 1386 of June 17, 1923. A concession for the construction of 800 kilometers of Sicilian railroads was granted two important fascist industrialists, Nicolini and Romano. The cost of the work was to be about a billion lira, and no government returns, rights, or privileges were asked. It was purely a big payoff to early subsidizers of fascism. And still later, talking about a Fortune magazine article both praising fascism and further documenting the enormous profits made by Mussolini's backers, Seldes writes, in its July 1934 issue, A Song of Praise for Fascism, Fortune magazine, owned by Henry Luce, a Morgan partner, and other powerful and wealthy Americans, told of the great corporations and how they progressed under Mussolini. Montecatini, for example, was listed as having assets of $77 million. It consumes 10% of the nation's electricity. It is managed by Gino Donagani with funds from the Banca Commerciale Italiana. Donagani is a, quote, fascist from the very beginning, unquote. Montecatini owns 51% of Acna Chemical Company, and IG Farben, the Hitler cartel, the other 49%. Signor Giovanni Agnelli, manager of Fiat, is, quote, one of the financial backers of the March on Rome. He stands high in fascist councils and has been a senator since the year one of fascism. He owns La Stampa, the leading Turin newspaper. Riccardo Gualino of Snia Viscosa, occupies the same place in Fascism for Money history as the bankers and industrialists who first backed Hitler and whom Hitler later purged. But Fortune, in 1934, reported, quote, along with Agnelli of Fiat and several other big capitalists, Gualino helped finance the March on Rome and in the early years of fascism flourished mightily, unquote. He went to jail later along with other fascist notables who resorted to common swindling in addition to the legal fascist way of draining the nation of its wealth. Martini and Rossi, The Vermouth and Cocktail Lords is run by Count Napoleon Rossi di Montalara, a member of the Fascist Party. Fratello Alberto and Pietro Pirelli own a $10 million company which in 1933 made a net profit of $1,500,000 thanks to Mussolini's help. Of course, Pirelli's own a very famous tire manufacturer. Bear in mind that we're talking about the 1930s and 40s here. $1 million was worth a whole lot more then than it is now. Continuing with Seldes' account. The Pirellis control 39 joint stock companies with a capital of 7,818 million lira. Agnelli controls 32 such corporations with a capital of 1,890 million lira. Senator Ettore Conti, president of the Banca Commerciale, the bank once headed by Giuseppe Toeplitz, T-O-E-P-L-I-T-Z, one of the many fascist Jews who supported Mussolini and who was treasurer and cashier for fascism, controls 18 firms with a capital of 3,474 million lira. The significant facts to hang on to, concluded Fortune, are these. If you were an early fascist or contributed generously to the March on Rome, you are likely to enjoy the business benefits that accrue to a high position within the fascist party. Curiously enough, Fortune and Luce's other publications, Time and Life, which had a long record before Pearl Harbor of applauding fascism, will not even now print any news which would in any way indicate that there is at least a slight resemblance between the former object of their affection and the constant love of their lives, the American big business equivalent of the fascist industrial system. And on the page opposite to that, Seldes has reprinted a headline from the New York Times of October 28, 1934. And this is going to begin to develop a theme that we're going to see throughout the rest of the broadcast this evening. We're going to take a look at just exactly how the American mainstream press not only covered for Mussolini's corporate state, but in particular how they also, in so doing, covered for the American financial institutions, the American corporate interests, which floated so many of the Italian bond issues, thereby placing Italy in debt to the United States. And in essence, Mussolini did, in a way, what the Reagan-Bush administrations have done. They have basically mortgaged the company to the country, to foreign capital. The New York Times, on October 28th of 1934, however, reported the situation in Mussolini's Italy as following. This is the headline. The New York Times, they have the New York Times logo there. Benefits of fascism viewed on birthday. In 13 years, regime regarded as having accomplished many laudable things in Italy. Now, this is October 28th, 1934, and we're going to take note during the rest of the broadcast about just how poorly Italy was doing at this time, the New York Times disclaimer to the contrary notwithstanding. By way of indicating just what kind of favor Mussolini was held in the United States, I'm going to recount here a detail which is included in the context, or included in the text, I should say, of the first Radio Free America show, Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 1. Reading again from Facts and Fascism by George Seldes, in 1935, Colonel William E. Easterwood, National Vice Commander of the American Legion, invited Mussolini to the Chicago Convention, made the Duce an honorary member of the American Legion, and pinned a button on him. Since the Legion has no honorary members, this action was later declared unconstitutional. So although later it was declared as being unconstitutional according to the American Legion Charter, Il Duce in 35 was named an honorary member of the American Legion. Now, obviously, one of the major reasons why the American Legion, which generally, at least at this period in history, was doing the bidding of the National Association of Manufacturers and major corporate interests, one of the reasons why the corporate state of Mussolini appealed to them was for the tremendous profits to be derived under that kind of a system. In addition, and this will take us to the next point we're going to go into, fascism was represented as being the antidote to world Bolshevism, to world communism. This obviously was of great interest. This made it a very positive thing in the eyes of industrialists and financiers. And although, in fact, Bolshevism in Italy, communism in Italy, was already on the decline when fascism came into place due to various political and economic factors, fascism continued to be represented both by Mussolini and his apologists abroad as the antidote to socialism. And fascism was presented as the ideal solution for seeing to it that socialism wouldn't come to any country. We're going to take a look at fascism as anti-Bolshevism when we come back from a musical break, and we're going to continue with tonight's broadcast, Uncle Sam and the Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. Now, resuming with tonight's broadcast, dealing with Mussolini's corporate state, One of the main reasons why Mussolini's corporate state had so much appeal for American industrialists and financiers, apart from the enormous profits to be derived under the corporate state, was that fascism was represented as being the antidote to socialism, the corporate state, and the resultant militant anti-labor violence that was an inherent part of the corporate state. This was seen as being an antidote to Bolshevism, to communism, socialism, Marxism, or whatever term one chooses to use. The fact of the matter is that at the end of World War I, in addition to the successful Bolshevik revolution in the Soviet Union, there were abortive Marxist revolutions in a number of different European countries. This terrified many of the industrialists and financiers around the world, who then sought a social system which was to be an antidote to the perceived threat of world socialism. Now, Mussolini's corporate state was seen as just this antidote and was touted as such by industrialists and financiers as well as Mussolini himself, despite the fact that Mussolini's fascism was not the explanation for the decline of Bolshevism in Italy and immediately after the First World War. In fact, the abortive communist revolution in Italy declined due to a number of factors. Mussolini's corporate state was not among them, as Mussolini himself admitted. Now, in order to examine fascism as anti-Bolshevism in a nutshell, we're going to turn to a landmark biography of Mussolini, and this author was authored by George Seldes. It's called Sawdust Caesar: The Untold History of Mussolini and Fascism. It's authored again by George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S, published in hardcover by Harper and Brothers, and copyright 1935 in hardcover. And of fascism as anti-Bolshevism, Seldes writes, "Simultaneously with the establishment of the corporate state came a series of loans in America and intensification of the propaganda, begun the year before when the $100 million Morgan loan was floated, that fascism was the antithesis of Bolshevism, that Mussolini had not only saved Italy but perhaps all of Europe from the Red Menace, that the corporate state was the answer to the universal utopian urge which elsewhere, notably in Russia, was making itself known in a manner quite unacceptable to the organized profit-making system. This new phenomenon, therefore, must be judged from three important points: whether it is actually the salvation from communism, quote-unquote, whether it actually functions, whether the people under the corporate state have gone forward or backward." Well, we're going to examine fascism as anti-Bolshevism, the clue of that, or the truth of that particular assertion, later in the broadcast, but we're going to begin by taking a look at the main features of fascist economics in Italy under Mussolini. We're going to take a look at some very important similarities, again, not exact analogies, but some very important similarities between the way Mussolini ran Italy and the way Ronald Reagan, first Ronald Reagan and now George Bush, have run the United States. Now, one of the most impressive and depressing similarities between the pro-business administration of Ronald Reagan and George Bush and that of Italy under Mussolini is the fact that, in spite of the enormous institutionalized corruption in both societies were kept afloat at least for a period of time. So far, the United States is still afloat, if you can call what's happening in February of 1990 afloat. The United States is still afloat, and Italy was kept afloat for a long period of time by basically mortgaging Italy to foreign lenders. Basically, the pumps, the economic pumps of Mussolini's Italy were primed by borrowing capital abroad. A tremendous amount of money was borrowed through the floating of bonds, primarily in the United States, and as a result, Mussolini ran huge budgetary deficits and mortgaged Italy to American lending institutions. Now, of Mussolini's borrowing of American capital, his mortgaging of Italy to American finance, and in turn, his use of this borrowed capital to build up the Italian military rather than Italian industry at the expense of the competitiveness of the Italian economy, similar to what's happening in the United States, George Seldes writes as follows in a book called Can These Things Be?, yet another of Seldes' many, many works. Can These Things Be? By George Seldes was published in hardcover by, well, it's copyright 1931, and it's published in hardcover by Brewer and Warren Incorporated, B-R-E-W-E-R and Warren Incorporated, long since vanished into the annals of American corporate history, no doubt. Now, of Mussolini's deficit financing, of his mortgaging of Italy to American finance, George Seldes writes as follows, and again, we're going to discuss some of the similarities between this and Reagan-Bush America in a minute. George Seldes writing in Can These Things Be? In order to carry on the myth of the balanced budget and the economic restoration of Italy, Mussolini has mortgaged Italy to American finance. American citizens now own about half billion, American citizens now own $500 million worth of Italy. Some of the principal borrowings, this list is not complete but is assuredly much longer, are Kingdom of Italy 7s, these are presumably the interest rates on the bond issues here. Kingdom of Italy 7s, $100 million, J.P. Morgan and Company, these are the financial institutions in this country which floated the loans. Kingdom of Italy 7s, $100 million, J.P. Morgan and Company, and again, bear in mind, a dollar worth much more in the 20s and 30s than it is now. City of Rome, 6.5s, $30 million, J.P. Morgan and Company. City of Milan, 6.5s, $20 million, Dillon Reed, Bankers Trust, and the Guarantee Trust. Credit Consortium 7s, $10 million, Morgan, National City, and the First National. Adriatic Electric 7s, $5 million, Blair and Company. Fiat 7s, $10 million, Morgan. International Securities, $35 million, Alfred and Company, Harris Forbes, and Bankers Trust. Italian Public Utility 7s, $20 million, Blair and Chase Securities. Lombard Electric 7s, $6 million, Blair, Chase, Rollins and Company. Mendionali Electric 7s, $10,250,000, Marshall Field, Glore, Ward, Blythe, Wither and Company. Montecalini Mineral 7s, $6 million, Guarantee Trust, Marshall Field, Glore, Ward, International Acceptance Bank. Pirelli 7s, $4 million, Morgan. United Electric 7s, $5 million, Rollins and Blair. Then it also is listed here with no financial institutions after them. Private Credits, $25 million. Snea Viscosa, $9 million. Electric Union, $6 million. Terni, $25 million. Ademello, $10 million. Isotta Frascini, $1,700,000. And the Rome Gas Company, $10 million. And Seldes goes on to comment, "And I am sure it will be a real pleasure to the Bolshevik-hating American public to know that a large part of the $500 million they put into Italy is being used to continue the black or anti-red terror. Perhaps it will be proud of the fact that American money is being used by Mussolini to create a fleet for the officially announced purpose of controlling the Mediterranean. What does this control mean? It means a war with England or France." Well, of course, later it was to mean a war with the United States as well. Worth noting here that as we saw in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast about U.S. industrial and financial support for Nazi Germany, American financial institutions helped float the loans to get the capital to build the very Italian military which was to take the lives of American servicemen during World War II. Also worth noting, very importantly for our purposes here, that the temporary perceived success of Mussolini's Italy, such as it was accomplished again by mortgaging Italy to American finance. It should be noted here, too, that the money borrowed was plowed by Mussolini in considerable measure into the building of the military rather than industry, rather than into improving Italian municipalities and utilities. Much of it was used for building up the Italian military. Of course, Ronald Reagan's huge budget deficits stem from the enormous defense budgets and the tax cuts which accompanied them. And again, the United States so far under Reagan Bush has been kept afloat basically by floating bonds. Basically, our T-bills have kept the United States from going under so far. Basically, the Japanese, Germans, and other major investors have underwritten America's debt incurred in order to build up the American military rather than American industry, this, of course, placing the United States in a less competitive international position. And again, I'm not suggesting in any way that this is an exact analogy, but I am suggesting that it is an important and valid analogy, and one which, again, is very, very scary for our purposes here. Now, one of the main ways in which Mussolini was able to continue to secure those American loans was by portraying his corporate state as a success, whereas in fact it was not a success. We're going to go into now the economic mythology of the corporate state, how it was maintained, that is to say, how that mythology was maintained, and in particular we're going to take a look at how the American press gave favorable coverage to Mussolini's corporate state, thereby serving to justify the investments of the American financial institutions who had floated the Italian bond issues, and also serving to justify the rationale behind the corporate state. Again, the American mainstream press covered for Mussolini and gave a coverage to Mussolini's Italy which was in defiance of the actual record, in defiance of the facts. Turning once again now to the book Sawdust Caesar, George Seldes' landmark biography of Mussolini's Italy, we're going to take a look now at one of the major aspects of fraudulent fascist finance, and one of the major aspects in which I think Mussolini's corporate state is comparable in certain important respects to the America of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Reading again from Sawdust Caesar, the he here, of course, is Mussolini. He flatly makes the statement that, quote, today we have a balanced budget. Self-ruling units, the provinces and the communes, have balanced their budgets, too. Exports and imports and their relationships are carried on in a precise and definite rhythm, that of our stabilized lira. We're going to take a look at the economic mythology now of Mussolini's Italy. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the myth of the balanced budget in Italy. We're also going to take a look at the myth of favorable balances of trade in Italy. Another similar characteristic between Reagan-Bush America and Mussolini's Italy is that both the Italy of Mussolini and the America of Reagan and Bush have run huge trade deficits. But first, of the mythology of the balanced budget. And again, I'm not suggesting this is an exact analogy between Mussolini's Italy and contemporary America, but I do think that the budgetary chicanery, the cooking of the books, the budgetary BS here, the way in which Mussolini used blatantly fraudulent bookkeeping in order to make it appear as if his deficit financing actually had produced, or his state had produced, a balanced budget rather than huge budget deficits, this cooking of the books, this budgetary BS that Mussolini engaged in is, as I said, very similar to what the Bush administration and the Reagan administration before it have done in the United States. Of the budgetary chicanery of Mussolini and how it was used to justify the economic status quo, George Seldes writes as follows in Sawdust Caesar. In 1925, the first reports were sent from Rome that jugglery, trickery, and distorted official figures and statements have marked fascist finance. The Irish journalist and former diplomatic attaché in Rome, James Murphy, has published in the German, French, British, and American magazines numerous articles charging fraud which have never been challenged. He states, for instance, that the fascisti, to maintain confidence and goodwill abroad, especially among banking interests, have organized a system of propaganda about their economic position, have given to the public, quote, a state budget which has little or no relation to the real financial condition. It is simply a piece of propaganda. I should not make such a statement without being in a position to bring forward proof. Take Di Stefani's budget for 1923-24. For that year, I find that under one heading alone, there was an expenditure of 14 billion of lira, $700 million, not a cent of which is debited in the state budget. The expenditure was officially announced in the official gazette. It figures in the treasury accounts, but it is carefully kept out of the budget that has been published. That sum alone would practically consume the whole income from taxation for the same year. Therefore, De Stefani's first budget had really a much heavier deficit than those of his predecessors, even if we confine the deficit to the above expenditure and say nothing of other treasury debts incurred. To keep all such questions dark, the press is muzzled, and foreign journalists are watched and persecuted lest they begin to pry into the question of Italy's finances. By such means, and by the expenditure of huge sums for propaganda abroad, the fascists think that they will be able to stave off the day when their real economic and financial position may become known to foreign bankers and foreign industrialists, unquote. Mr. Murphy likewise questions both Mussolini and American bankers on the subject of balanced budget by the municipalities. Quote, one of the immediate purposes of the dictatorship obtaining control of the municipalities, he declares, is the facilitation of fascism's shady finance. It is well known that a favorite trick practiced since Mussolini got control of things is to falsify the state budget by transferring state expenses to the municipal budgets. All the municipal budgets show a deficit, but this does not appear in public. And there will be no chance of its coming into the light now when there will be no local supervisors appointed by the people. The system will be understood if we imagine all the municipalities as subordinate corporations grouped under the one parent corporation, which is the state. The balance sheets of the subordinate corporations are being thrown more and more into a state of insolvency in order to make the parent balance sheet look healthy. Yet the parent corporation is solely dependent on the solvency of all the subordinated corporations taken together. American financiers who have visited Italy have been too simple-minded to spot this trick. They have also been too simple-minded to ask for the treasury accounts and collate them with the budget. And so the fascist financial bluff has gone ahead triumphantly. Mussolini wants to show the unwary Yankee how splendidly everything is going in Italy so that he can raise loans in the United States, unquote. To such general statements must be added the official figures from the fascist government's publications. The debts of the provinces as of January 1, 1925 are 954 million, and January 1, 1928, 1,326 million, while the debts of the capital cities of the provinces are as follows. January 1st, 1925, 3,066,000,000. January 1st, 1928, 5,481,000,000. Increase in debt, 2,415,000,000 lira. Which somehow does not agree with Mussolini's statement that, quote, the provinces and the communes have balanced their budgets too, unquote. Fascist Italy, say European economists, is the only country in the world which announces balanced budgets while showing deficits in the treasury. Perhaps they would change, or Seldes would change that assessment, as would the European economists, had they had the opportunity to view contemporary America. Of the mythology of Mussolini's favorable balance of trade, which was accomplished, again, through assessing Italians abroad very, very expensive remittances, of the fascist fraud of a favorable balance of trade, Seldes writes as follows, again from Sawdust Caesar. The American commercial attaché, H.C. McLean, reported from Rome on January 16, 1928, that, quote, the outstanding characteristic of Italy's relations with the rest of the world is the large excess of the country's merchandise imports over its merchandise exports, a condition prevailing for many years. To compensate the large adverse trade balance in visible terms, notably remittances from Italians resident abroad and expenditures of foreign tourists in Italy, must be largely depended upon, unquote. The attaché then points out an adverse trade balance of almost 5 billion lira for the first 10 months of 1927, adding, quote, having accepted 5 billion as Italy's adverse trade balance and 1,500,000,000 as its net outgo on financial transactions, we have a total of 6,500,000,000 lira for which compensation must be found on the credit side of the country's international accounts. He then shows that emigrants' remittances have sharply declined, whereas in 1926, the withdrawals from postal savings banks were practically compensated by new deposits. During the first 10 months of 1927, such withdrawals exceeded deposits by no less than 570 million lira. So again, the fraudulent aspects of Mussolini's claims for a favorable balance of trade here set forth by Seldes. Now, one of the major points of this broadcast is that the mainstream American press, acting in concert with the perceived interests of corporate America, I guess you could say, continued to parrot the various aspects of corporate mythology, of the mythology of Mussolini's corporate state, and they fell right into line with the propagation of the myth, and we've just seen what a myth that is, of Mussolini's balanced budget. Seldes writes as follows of the American press's parroting of the mythology of the balanced budget in Sawdust Caesar. It was nothing short of a miracle. The sun of economic fatality stood still in the heavens at the command of the prophet, and the American international bond floaters sang the epic of the great deed as they issued $600 million in loans to Italy. $600 million American dollars is a sum. It was surely worth the employment of Public Relations Council with the aid of the banking houses in protecting it. Time after time, between 1925 and 1929, the American public dumped the Italian bonds back on the market, and each time the dozen houses which floated them intensified their campaign, which created the Mussolini balanced budget myth, while they threatened the banking and brokerage firms which represented them with cutting them off from participation in future business if they failed to dispose of the Italian goods. The Duce, of course, has always been party to the financial myth-making. He declared the stabilization at 19 was approved by, quote, profound experts in financial questions. That's the stabilization of the lira, which turned out to be a disaster. But it was later proven that Finance Minister Volpe and his good friend Andrew W. Mellon had advised against that figure. It was always the head of the government who struck the note for the orchestra of the press to follow. When the bankers and the press agents and the Italians who wrote for the Associated Press and the American newspapers reported the stabilization at 19 to the dollar of victory, that Bolshevism threatened in 1922, that the budgets had balanced, that the municipalities were out of the red, literally and figuratively, and that prosperity had crowned the planned economy of fascism up to 1929, they are but playing variations on the tune which the master musician originated. That last sentence again. When the bankers and the press agents and the Italians who wrote for the Associated Press and the American newspapers reported the stabilization at 19 to the dollar of victory, that Bolshevism threatened in 1922, that the budgets had balanced, that the municipalities were out of the red literally and figuratively, and that prosperity had crowned the planned economy of fascism up to 1929, they are but playing variations on the tune which the master musician originated. And as we're going to see here, The continued perpetuation of the economic and political mythology of the corporate state was a major occupation of the American press during that period. We're going to take another short musical break, and we're going to come back taking a look at just how Mussolini and the American press propagated the myth of an improvement in the lifestyle of the average Italian under fascism, whereas in fact the standard of living of the average Italian plummeted under fascism, unless of course you were one of the main backers of Mussolini's party. We're next going to approach another aspect of the economic mythology of Mussolini's corporate state, and specifically we're going to take a look at how Mussolini propagated the myth that his corporate state improved the standard of living of the average Italian. In fact, the standard of living for the average Italian worker, as might be expected, plummeted under fascism. Mussolini misrepresented that, and once again, we're going to see the pattern of the American press covering, basically, for Mussolini, perpetuating the lie that Mussolini first generated concerning the myth of the improvement of the standard of living for the average Italian. Returning once again to Sawdust Caesar by George Seldes, of the myth of the improvement of the Italian lifestyle under Mussolini. However, the only important thing for us to consider is whether, functioning or not as a corporate state, the fascist system of planned economy, the substitute for the planned economy of Bolshevism, has or has not achieved anything up to date. It is Mussolini who said that the state's ultimate goal is, quote, the well-being of the Italian people, unquote. It must be, quote, judged and measured directly by the masses as instruments through which these masses may improve their standard of living. Someday the worker, the tiller of the soil, will say to himself and to others, quote, if today I am better off practically, I owe it to the institutions which the fascist revolution has created, unquote. Interrupting here briefly, that reminds me in a way of the campaign slogan that Reagan used for his second campaign in 1984. Basically, the Reagan Revolution asked the question about whether or not, basically they asked the American electorate to consider whether or not you're better off than you were 4 years ago. Again, I'm not suggesting this is a precise analogy, but it's similar. Again, Mussolini writing here, someday the worker, the tiller of the soil, will say to himself and to others, quote, if today I am better off practically, I owe it to the institutions which the fascist revolution has created, unquote. In just this manner, let the following facts pass judgment. This again is Seldes writing. In 1926, when the few untrammeled journalists reported that there was already a crisis in fascist economics and that the publicly announced balanced budgets were mere jugglery, official figures showed that wages were below 1921 and that the cost of living had gone up 30%. In 1927, with the stabilization of the lira, Mussolini found a much more serious economic crisis. He therefore announced a reduction in rentals, reduction in the price of manufactured goods, and a wage cut throughout the nation of between 5 and 20%. He promised that the cuts ordered in the high cost of living would more than recompense the reductions in salary. At that time, the general price index was 670, wages stood at 585. In real wages, the workman was 13% worse off than before the war. That fascism had proved a failure so far as the working population of Italy is concerned long before the world crisis of 1929-35 is openly admitted in the 1932 report of the Secretary of State for Corporations, who wrote, quote, between June 1927 and December 1928, the wages of industrial workers have gone down by about 20%, and a further reduction of 10% was made in 1929. During 1930, there has been a general reduction varying for the different categories of workers from 18% to 25%. Many other adjustments have been realized in 1931, unquote. But that is not all. The decree effective December 1, 1930, cut the salaries of those earning more than $3,000 a year by 35% and those below $2,000 by 12%, and wages of 300 lira, $15.70, to 1,000 lira, $52.35 a month, 8%, and those above 1,000 lira, 10%. This cut affected 1 million laborers in the industrial centers of the North, Milan, Turin, and Genoa. The government announced it hoped, unquote, to reduce prices of commodities accordingly. Skipping down, and George Seldes next writes not only about the decline of the Italian standard of living under Mussolini for most people, that is, of course, unless you were one of his main fascist backers, but he talks about how the American press continued to misrepresent what was actually a decline in the Italian standard of living, or in the standard of living for the average Italian, and this was misrepresented as gains by the American press. Again, the same sort of perpetuation of the economic mythology of Mussolini's corporate state that we looked at vis-a-vis the balanced budget. To complete the chronicle, it was announced by Mussolini on December 11, 1934, that a nationwide and simultaneous reduction in salaries and the cost of living was being worked out, which directly affected every person in the kingdom, directly and indirectly, the cut being similar to that of October 1930, and similarly carrying with it a reduction in cost of rent, light, heat, food, and transport of between 10 and 12%. But instead of mentioning the obvious collapse of the fascist economy, the American press heralded each of these seven events with an appropriate excuse furnished by the fascist propaganda department. The headlines, for example, said that the 1927 cut was due to the success of the stabilization on a gold basis. In 1933, Mr. Cortese of the Times supplied a story which was headed, quote, "Italy cuts wages to aid recovery," unquote. The first 1934 reduction was linked with one in Russia, and the joint headline read, "Russia and Italy slash payrolls in economy wave," unquote. The second 1934 cut was reported by the Times as, quote, Italy to slash wages and cost of living to meet competition of non-gold nations." So once again, we see the perpetuation by the American news media of the mythology of Mussolini's corporate state. And obviously, at least until the extent of the fraud became evident, this served the interests of those American lending institutions which had helped finance Mussolini's deficits, and in turn those American corporate interests that saw Mussolini's corporate state as a positive phenomenon. Now, as indicated earlier in the broadcast, one of the main selling points for fascism, one of the main selling points of the corporate state, is that it was represented as the antidote to Bolshevism. At the end of World War I, as I mentioned, they were successful in the Soviet Union and unsuccessful in other countries, communist uprisings, and this panicked many of the world's top industrialists and financiers, who then turned to fascism as the antidote to the perceived threat of Bolshevism. Now, although the American press, as well as Mussolini himself, represented fascism as the reason why the abortive socialist uprising in Italy failed, in point of fact, other political and economic factors produced the decline in the popularity of Marxism among the Italian workers. And beyond that, Mussolini himself admitted that fascism was not the reason why Bolshevism failed in Italy. It was not fascism that turned Bolshevism away. Bolshevism was already on decline, was already in decline due to a number of independent factors, fascism not being among them. Mussolini himself even admitted this in an editorial. This is covered by George Seldes in Sawdust Caesar as follows. To begin with, it must be said that despite the best American Public Relations Council employed by the international bankers, despite the newspapers and magazines which voluntarily surrendered to the fascist propaganda machine, it is an historic fact that the whole Mussolini-Bolshevik story was a pure myth which dates from the time of the foreign loans, and the most important historian who first admitted that the Bolshevism of 1920, the worst year, the time of the occupation of factories, had disappeared long before the victory of fascism, wrote in 1921, quote, "The Italy of 19..." Now, by the way, this is Mussolini himself writing in an editorial here. "The Italy of 1921 is fundamentally different from that of 1919. It has been said and demonstrated several times. Fascism must not have the air of monopolizing for itself the right of such a profound national change. It is enough to count fascism among the forces the most powerful and the most disciplined which have operated in that direction. After having thus limited our merit, there is no man or party which can attack us. To say that the Bolshevik danger still exists in Italy is equivalent in trying to exchange, for reasons of self-interest, fear against the truth. Bolshevism is conquered. More than that, it has been disowned by the leaders and by the people." This editorial is signed by Benito Mussolini. Basically, Mussolini admitting that by 1921, before his march on Rome, Bolshevism was in decline. But in spite of the fact that even Mussolini himself, although he was later to trumpet fascism again as the antidote to Bolshevism, despite the fact that Mussolini himself admitted that this was not the case, again, the American press, the American news media, continued to parrot the official Mussolini line of fascism as the effective antidote to Bolshevism. Seldes writes of this as follows. "But popular opinion, and the bankers, needed a St. George and therefore refused to accept St. George's own admission that there was no Bolshevik dragon for him to kill in 1922. Popular opinion, therefore, finds consolation in those American economists, litterateurs, and philosophers of the daily press and weeklies which boast readers by the millions. One of these writers states that ruin impended, Mussolini took the short and unconstitutional cut, which is the dictatorial way. He smashed precedents, turned red terror into white fear, and brought order and, what was even more important, economic revival out of the dust and din of class war and political bicker.